Welcome to the State of API, a podcast about APIs. We cover everything API, from productizing and monetizing APIs through to managing, developing, and scaling APIs. I'm Scott Middleton from Terram, and throughout this series, I'll be interviewing experts and leaders in the field of APIs, as well as sharing my own views from time to time. All right. Hey, Eric. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello. Hello.
Well, welcome to the podcast. Eric, we've got a couple of things to cover today. We're going to talk a little bit about REA to begin with. That's realestate.com.au, really, and a few other businesses involved in that. We're going to talk about the role of APIs at realestate.com.au and particularly around APIs in the role of a two-sided marketplace. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the three Ps of API, but we're probably going to meander in different directions as well. So I hope everyone's up for it. So just to kind of kick us off, could you tell us a little bit for the audience, just a bit of context around REA and REA's business?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. Great to be here. So REA is a Melbourne success story. I think started in 98, 99, three guys in their garage in the suburbs. Started a website, realestate.com.au. Most of you probably heard of it. The numbers are getting out of control. I think in Australia, we've really got a problem with property. The numbers I'm quoting are roughly 12.5 million unique visitors a month and about 125 million visits a month. That's somewhere like 50% of the population of Australia, like 60% of the adult population is on realestate.com.au looking at property every month. It's a little mind-boggling, wondering why the property prices are so high all the time. But REA Group has other brands, realcommercial.com.au, Flatmates, some mortgage broking in Mortgage Choice, and some international businesses as well. So it's grown into a Melbourne success story with some good growth. Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about the program around APIs and the platform for APIs.
Yeah, sure. So I guess we can break it down. There's two main brands for APIs out of REA. One is PropTrack. PropTrack is a new business that's selling property data to banks doing valuations on properties using data science. And the area that I'm from is an API suite we've got called Partner Platform. It's being rebranded to Ignite APIs, but it's essentially the customer-facing APIs. And when we say customer, we're talking about real estate agents. How do we get the data in the hands of the real estate agents when they post a property to advertise on realestate.com.au?
And this is something I really want to touch on with you is the customers, the real estate agent, REA is really known for as a consumer looking to buy a house. I can log on, I can see the property and everything. So yeah, how do you think about APIs as a product, as a business offering within REA?
Yeah, great one. So the customer we consider the real estate agent, but we know they're not techie, right? They're not so digitally savvy. So how do we get the data that we have back into the hands of the agent and justify, you know, REA is the right place to advertise? So that we've got kind of a marketplace where we've got a bunch of prop tech businesses around Australia, and last count there's about 180 of them, and they change from large CRMs that manage, you know, listing upload to multiple portals and lead management, and there's a lot of smaller side businesses. So we've got an API platform that is consumed by other businesses who then sell the service to the real estate agent. And they're offering a service that is, you can push your listings to all the different portals in Australia for advertising, not just realestate.com.au. So we really need to have this API platform available for these 100-something odd prop tech businesses so they can interact with our data and service our shared customers. So it's really a shared customer system.
What you've said makes it even more interesting, because there's now another part, like there's not just the end consumer using the app. There's now a bunch of third parties or middle parties involved in that. They're the prop tech companies or technology businesses or whoever. I'm guessing there's some that aren't even tech companies that are using the API, sitting between you and your customer, the real estate agent. How do you think about that? Are the prop tech companies your primary customer? Do you go on to focus on them when you're doing research around what people want? Do you go and spend time with the agents? Do you go and spend time with consumers thinking about where that's headed? How does that all come together?
It's such a difficult balancing act, right? Because traditionally you would chase the money. Who's the one paying us? Well, the real estate agents are paying to advertise. They're paying a subscription to advertise. So we have a financial interest with the agents. Everything we do is there to support the agent. And then you balance that support with how do you make a good consumer experience of people looking to buy houses. You want to provide them with enough information so they can keep using your website. But then the ones you're actually targeting for our APIs is these prop tech businesses that have their own businesses, their own roadmaps, their own desire for growth. And there's a tricky balance, right? Because we can release some features or something on our API. But then how do you get it into the hands of the agent? Well, you need to convince them, a third-party business that you don't have a financial relationship with, saying, I've got something for our shared customers. Can you please add this to your roadmap and grow the adoption of our systems or release the data points that we want to do? So it's really a tricky balance here. And I think you've got to look at all strategies. You've got to make your data really easy to consume or really get the sales pitches right on them to convince a third party to want to integrate.
And in light of that, what have you learned about and how do you think about the purpose of your API in that context? Like what's its goal? Why does it exist?
Yeah, exactly. Let's maybe take a little history lesson then. So if we look when our API gateway probably started, for the last 10 years or more, REAs received listings via an FTP server, and it was really a one-way communication. You jump 5 years beyond that, so maybe the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've provided reporting and leads API. So you send us a property to advertise, and we'll send you the leads, the consumer people who are interested, as well as reporting on how your campaign is going. And that's really what started spawning the API platform that we have. We need to provide leads and listings back. Next step, we deprecate our FTP and we switch everyone over to an API. So we've got data coming in and data going out. And from that, we've had now growth of more teams creating more data points, more complex reports, more side-on businesses that need to create an API so these CRMs can interact with our business and do different side products. So there's really an organic growth that has caused this.
Yeah, interesting. And the how then do you think about, was that driven by those middle prop tech players coming, the software providers who are integrating with you coming and saying, hey, we want this information, we want these leads coming from you? Was that driven?
That's
by
very customer driven, right? So the customer would traditionally get a lead by an email if you go back in the days.
And the agents
email,
yeah,
copy pasting it into their CRM because they want a single place to put the leads and take them all from all domains. And then the CRMs got a little bit smarter, and then they implemented email scraping. So they put like an email address from a CRM, it gets scraped directly into the CRM. We say that's not good. It's not viable. It's hard for us to modify and add new data points and all that kind of thing. So we switch to an API, and now we try and encourage the CRMs to say, hey, I know you've got a system that works, but here's an API that's more reliable, more secure. It's going to have more growth. Please migrate over.
It's really interesting, the completely kind of, let's call it messy evolutionary approach. Sometimes so easy, I think, in product and technology to sit back and go, well, we're going to have this excellent plan where we're just going to do X, Y, Z and this will happen. But actually, there's a nice, I actually like the evolutionary approach where you're leading the way a bit, then the software partners are leading the way a bit, those tech, the people consuming the API, and then the customers as well, probably leading the way a bit saying, hey, and it's probably either to you or to their customer, their CRM providers or whoever it might be saying, hey, these agents saying, hey, I don't want to have to rekey information. Can you fix this for me? And it sounds like this really interactive evolution versus we sat there and decreed there shall be API.
Exactly. If you do that, you're never going to succeed. You're going to sit stagnant and never get adoption. You've got to attack it from all angles. You've got to go out to the end user. We've got a great sales team who are out there talking to our customers and say, This new data is available. Talk to your CRM if you want it available in your main tool. Otherwise, you can use our native web and app experiences and consume that data. But if you want it in your CRM, talk to your CRM about integrating it. So there's pressure applied from the customer. And then as a platform, what can we do? We can, you know, tailor our API doc experiences from being more dev focused to being more sales pitch focused. So, you know, the upper management in the CRM can look at our suite and go, oh, that's cool. Maybe I'll add this to our roadmap to integrate with that piece of data.
Oh, interesting. So what you're saying is one of the things you're adopting at the moment is that there's that dual track documentation that I like to think of dev experience and sales experience.
Yeah, we're not quite there, but that's definitely on the next roadmap of the very immediate things. Because if you want adoption, you've got to make it easy for the different people who are going to consume that. And you, as in your documentation needs to target your managers, also have another bit that targets the developers. You want to make it super easy to consume your data, right? So the API consumer doesn't have to spend a month to build something out. They can build it out in a week or two. It goes back to the old 5-5-5 rule. You know, 5 seconds to understand what an API does, 5 minutes to make your first request, 5 hours to build a prototype. And yeah, that is the gold standard of what you should be trying to target.
That's it. Yeah. And so just still on this topic of purpose of the API, how do you measure success? Like, what's the thing where you're sitting down with your team and you're kind of going, cool, we succeeded, or we've still got more to go? What are your measures of success?
One of our big ones is adoption, because we've got such a barrier trying to influence this middleman to adopt when they've got their own roadmaps. So we measure the adoption. And when you adopt one CRM, they will have different market shares of number of real estate agencies that they represent. So we look at a total market ownership levels. So we say there's roughly 10,000 real estate agencies in Australia. If we onboard one of our bigger customers or bigger partners, the CRMs, they may, you know, bring 10% of the market with them. Another one only brings 1% of the market. So we look at it as adoption per partner, as well as adoption based on how many customers we're now getting this into the hands of.
Yeah, interesting. And how do you balance that with evolving a bit? Because sometimes those big CRMs are going to be hesitant to
definitely
make changes and move, and they're probably... Yeah, how do you balance that with, there's probably some innovators out there like, oh, I'd love an API because then I can get an edge.
Definitely, definitely. Some of the smaller ones that are hungry for market share, they're very quick to adopt. You know, we've got friendly partners that we integrate, go and beta test with, share our ideas, get their feedback, and we know that they're quick adopters and they'll give us good feedback. And then you've got some of the bigger players that, no, I've already got good market share. We've already got a different roadmap. We're focusing on something else. They're the harder ones to kind of adopt. In the prop tech markets also, what I've seen is there's a lot of press statements that come out about big acquisitions and mergers happening. So we're getting a lot of the major CRMs merging together and representing more and more of the business. And in a time of merger, you always get flux. You always get, I lost my contact here, or it's who do I talk to now? All right, they've probably got other things about how do they consolidate their tech rather than adopt new tech. So it's a bit of a flux time at the moment.
Yeah, okay. And what is it going a little off? What does it look like in your view to be a good, as someone on the other side, if I'm a CRM developer, I'm a technology developer, I've got a cool new idea, or even I'm kind of the incumbent, like what does it look like from your point of view, and for good partners to work with, and like what can partners do to feature well? Because I know, like, as much as we all like to use disciplined systems of prioritization, everything, at the end of the day, though, if there's really friendly people to work, friendly is maybe the wrong word, but really good people to work with, you will often take ideas to them earlier and workshop things with people earlier, and we all have our biases. So I'm just kind of curious, like, what does it look like for a good partner to work with REA?
It's human nature, isn't it, right? Like, the person who smiles at you, you're more likely to stop and have a joke or have a conversation. Yeah. And if you've got this closer level of trust with each other that you're not trying to, you know, steal secrets, it goes a long ways of opening up and sharing the information. So for me, a good partner, a good someone to work with is someone friendly that you can bounce ideas off, a complete safe space. There is no wrong answer. We'd like to do a lot of API design first. So, you know, come up with, we've got this idea. Does this bit of data, would something like this help you? Okay, let's workshop what an interface may look like for this. What data points are active? Are we doing it live data? Are we doing it, you know, are we polling? Are we doing monthly reports? How are we going to consume this data? And then once we've got that kind of stuff, we'll probably roadshop it with another couple. Just make sure we've got consistency. I always believe in the rule of three. You don't have a pattern until you've seen three occurrences of it. So try and get this feedback and then only then start development.
My it's funny you got the rule of 3 months, a rule of seven, because it tends to throw me. Name seven times, this could work. Everyone gets to about three and then falls over with it. But anyway, sometimes you've got to go off less information. Yeah, interesting. The other thing that strikes me is also in the work I've done around APIs on both sides of the fence is probably partners that and consumers of an API that will also actually follow through and build things and work on things in that nice kind of iterative manner together, because it's one thing to talk a lot, but I've definitely built stuff, shipped it to people, they don't consume it, you don't gain any feedback, and it's kind of a bit of a waste of time versus someone who gets in, gives it a crack, even if they're not the biggest partner, is almost way more useful than people are all talk.
I think this is a great segue, and if you look at how team structures can be. So we've got an API platform, but it goes hand in hand with a native web and app experience. And internally, when we've got a lot of feature teams who build, the first instinct is always to build in the native web and app experience. Why? Because you have complete control over both sides. You can build the interface, you can modify the interface, you can change the data at will because you completely control end-to-end to the glass. And it's easy. It's what we're used to doing, right? We're used to building a web app and maybe building a product and shipping it and putting the right analytics on it and then modifying it as you go. And it's easy to control. But the API space can be scary because it can be, let's build, get great intention, put it out there, and then it sits dormant for 2 years. It's a much slower system to get out. And it's once it is out, it's hard to change. It's hard to do versioning.
Yeah.
No one wants to do it.
On the flip side, if you've got the API out there, it might be dormant for a year or two, but then you might see all these shoots of growth and innovation happen, and you kind of get a leverage factor that you can't get.
That's nirvana, right? Once you've got the ecosystem out there, you don't need to invest as much in your own native web and app experiences. You can let the organic growth of smaller businesses who use your data, as long as you're sitting on a mountain of data and you're the king on top of the gold mine, you can share the data out and get more growth from other businesses that can then find new markets for you that you don't have to invest in.
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic that one of our other episodes really goes into depth on as well. Just the by opening up the ecosystem, you stand to gain a lot more than by having a not even closed ecosystem, but just a closed environment. Those open ecosystems are proven to build huge amount of value for the businesses that create them. So that's kind of spot on point.
It brings in fresh ideas. You get out of the echo chamber from your own business,
and
you start getting people thinking differently. How do they use the data for something else?
Yeah, let's kind of dig into that a bit more around, you're talking about the different teams. So just give us a bit more color around at REA, just the environment you're dealing with. I think you're saying you've got quite a few squads that are all able, like armed, so to speak, to build APIs. What's that look like? How many kind of teams are working on APIs at any given time?
Yeah, sure. So I'm from an area called customer channels, and the channels represent the API channel, the web, and the app experience channel, and they all try and deliver kind of feature parity or a parity of data across those three channels. Our web and app experience are built off the same API gateway or API platform, so they're getting data from the same place and presenting it on the glass, or customer can consume our APIs if they want the data themselves. In there, there's 10 or 15 squads working across these channels or building features into our native web and app experience. And when they build them into native web and app experience, they're typically also put on the API gateway by default, right? They need the data in the web and app. Well, they're putting it behind the gateway and then it's already there. And then we can choose to share it or open it up or make it available. Usually it's about publicly documenting it and having a go-to-market strategy around the API as well.
So just to unpack that a bit. So your teams build straight up for your API. However, you may not publish those APIs publicly, but they're essentially built ready to go public. Is that right? Like for whatever.
Correct. All those APIs will be behind our gateway, and that gateway is consumed by our web and app experiences. You know, we have an experience API in between that consumes that same data and then present it to the native experiences.
So when a team builds a feature, they're also building an API. And then what's your kind of role in that? Are you involved early in helping shape what the API looks like? Are your teams already trained? Mm. What is that? Let's kind of bring it right from someone's got an idea for a new feature. What does that look like?
So slight history. I was in that native experience team for many years from its inception. Over the last year or year and a bit, I started a new role to REA, which we've called API lead. It's been pitched as a bit of a three-sided one. It's a technical product manager means a tech lead means an API evangelist. What does that kind of mean? Well, part of my role is working externally and helping CRMs integrate and building up a stronger relationship to try and get that adoption and answer a lot of those technical questions. Internally, it's about helping teams internally build APIs. What do the standards look like when you build them? What are authorization authentication patterns? What can they get for free by putting their API in our platform? What are the capabilities they get for free? And they can just focus really on the data. And then going around, and coaching people about how to build good APIs and setting up, connecting the outside world and the inside world so they can talk and really figure out what to build and what's the right way to build it.
Do you get the occasional, Eric, like, why are you talking to me? I know how to build an API. Well, leave me alone. I've been a developer for 15 years. Like, I think I know what a RESTful API is.
And I guess that's not what I'm trying to teach. I'm trying to teach that consistency is king. With any API, like the goal to me is if you've got 15 APIs behind that gateway, I want them to look like they're built by a single person. I want that API consumer on the outside of the world to look at your APIs and go, oh, they're all got the same language, the same patterns, the same query structure. It should be super easy for them to use. And that's got to be consistency.
Same documentation style, I'm guessing, as well. So, all right. So you got these APIs built, you've coached the teams, they've listened to your feedback, and you've got this awesome kind of API built. It's sitting there privately. It's maybe being consumed by a new feature of REA's own apps, either web or mobile. What's then the process of, hey, we're going to release this to our partners? What does that look like?
Yeah, sure. Usually it's kind of a beta program to start with, so we can get that feedback. The partners that helped us develop the API usually got some level of commitment from them to adopt. So there'll be already email chains going back and forward. Hey, here's a spec. Are you happy with it? Yes. Get some kind of adoption. But how do you go from broader than that? Well, I think this is something we can improve on a lot. But our current strategies are kind of three-pronged. Update your developer portal so the data is at least public. Then an email blast to go out to your partners who you think this will be useful for and let them make them aware. That usually is not very effective because, another email from REA kind of gets ignored. We could do things like monthly newsletters about our API and where it's at, but really you don't get enough growth or change to do something monthly, I think, and yearly, it doesn't quite feel right. The other pronged attack is going to talk to your customers who want the data. So empowering our sales teams to have the conversations with the shared customer and say, hey, this is available, this is something you're paying for with your subscription to REA that you're not getting benefit from. How about talking to your CRM and say, I want that? And if enough people want it, the CRM is more likely to adopt it.
Makes sense. And do you also put time, kind of one-on-one time, into walking through things with the CRM providers and your other API consumers?
We do a little bit of kind of road showing with some of our bigger franchise customers, you know, the Ray Wyatts, those yep. kind of large franchise groups, and having a chat with them. They usually can get a CRM to play ball if they need. But also doing a few with our larger CRMs, because it's a big list, and maybe the top 10 represent 80% of the market. And talking to those regularly gets pretty good results, but it's a challenge. It's really one of the hardest things we do when you don't have control of that middle ground and you try and influence.
Yeah, and it's almost, unless you're an API where you're an API platform where your customers, you're directly providing an API to your customers yeah. for direct usage, I think it's a very common challenge everyone has of there's usually something in between, a software provider or something else in between, and you've got to influence. It's a softer touch approach. And
it's the carrot or the stick. When we shut down FTP, we had to go out with the stick. You know, we say in 2 years, the FTP channel is shut down, migrate to the API. And you give 2 years of warning. But in the last 3 months of that 2 years, I'm chasing, you know, 50% of them saying, hey, this thing's shutting down. Are you ready? Are you going to be migrated off? And yeah, if there's no financial benefit, how do you get them to do it? It's not going to increase their revenue line by releasing a feature that we want released.
Yeah. You got to explain and sell the benefits to get on roadmaps. And it's interesting because some of it is, especially around things like this, it's often sometimes hard to quantify in the small amounts, but then taken together, you know, generally speaking, we can all say using the latest technology makes things better, right? It's easy to make a motherhood statement like that, but there's also one, if it ain't broke.
That's right. Don't the fix security it. Is increased if you get off email scraping, but email scraping's worked. It doesn't usually leak. And maybe once every 6 months, the email template changes and we have to update it. But that's my developer spends 2 hours and we're back up and running.
Yeah.
You all better jump to your API and I've got to handle complexities, webhooks, different patterns. Maybe I've got to put a developer on there for 2 weeks to get that kind of thing done.
Yeah. It's just it can be just seen as a cost of doing it.
Another strategy we've actually been toying with and we haven't implemented, but is this like publicly list of gold standard partners or partners who are quick to adopt. So you can publish a list out, and if you've got a big enough brand, you can say, all right, here are all the partners or the providers that a real estate agent may want to choose. And of those, these are the ones that are connected to these APIs or consume this data from us. And then you can clearly show, well, this CRM has probably more features than the other one based on what data they're getting from us.
Okay. So you're kind of championing your best. You're championing your community members in a way.
Exactly.
And spotlighting those that are being innovative, constantly investing, because it's also one of investment, you know, that are investing in their platforms in an ongoing way.
I've called some CRMs where we asked them to migrate off FTP. And they said, oh, we haven't touched, it's an old desktop app. We haven't touched it in 10 years. And the guy who built it, he's gone. He went 8 years ago. Well, if you're not investing in your system, like, are you doing the right thing for your customers?
Yeah. I mean, I must say I've been on the other side and I've felt that pain because it's also, you may also have a whole bunch of customers that don't, they're also having the same conversation with their customers. Hey, we've got a new version of the software. Do you want to migrate across? Oh, well, I would. I'm on the old version. It still works.
We know it. We don't have to train anyone. Yeah.
So I definitely feel the pain. Just kind of changing tack a little bit. So just jumping back up to the high level across APIs, something that you're quite passionate about is the three Ps of APIs.
Yeah.
I'd love it if you could share a bit with everyone around what it is, what it means, and then we can talk to it a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I think the three Ps to me are the product, the platform, and the program, right? So if we touch on each of these and how they kind of evolve, I think there's a common thought in the API landscape that you can't treat APIs purely as a product. They're just a transport layer, right? The product is something that you know there's a market fit. You've got something that could work, and APIs are just a way of delivering that, and it's probably evolved over time. If we look at Netflix, it was DVDs in an envelope, switch to a web app, and it's conceivable that it'll go to an API as well. It's just changing the product is still sharing a movie or whatever it is, and you've got the market audience that hasn't changed. You're just changing the way that the data is being consumed. So changing this mindset of I do a lot of work with product managers who say, how am I going to run this as a product? Well, no, you already have the product. What we're here to discuss is how do we make it consumable? How do we make it easier to consume?
It's really interesting. Yeah, the products often can be, look, it can be a single API in some instances. Stripe is potentially a good example, or Twilio with SMS, where it's, you know, you're doing one thing, you're collecting a payment, and it's one API. But then, you know, the product is collecting a payment, exactly. And the API is a delivery mechanism for doing it, which is exactly to your point. Could be multiple APIs, or that the APIs may not be a central player in the product at all. And I imagine it varies based on what, you know, what it is that's being worked on, what the product managers have got in mind at REA.
I think this comes to a really part that opened my mind a lot when I realized this thought. If you look at the evolution of how does an API platform grow, well, typically it starts in a business as there's already a product, and then one team builds something and another team needs it, so they produce it as an API, becomes an internal API, probably has no documentation, authorization. It's just shared on the same private network. Another team starts to use it, and maybe another one, and you start with one API, and another team over here builds their own API. Kind of different. There's no talking about it. But then you start organically getting three or four private APIs, and someone in the business says, well, we probably should put them together, make it a little bit more consistent. And then a higher up manager somewhere wants to buy a new yacht. So he comes up with the idea of, hey, we've got some partners out there, some external friendly people we do business with. Let's provide them the data. And suddenly your internal organic APIs that are rough and bit spaghettified need to become public. So then you quickly put an API gateway in front of it. You come up with some authorization rules. You probably come up with some API keys. You put some real basic documentation, or you even start emailing like Swagger docs around to friendly partners. And this organic growth of your API starts getting investment. You start building a bit nicer features for your partner. But that it's natural. We go from internal APIs to partner APIs. That same exec has got two promotions and he's now really up on the board, and he goes, let's make a revenue out of this, right? So now you've got to scramble and you go, how do I make these public APIs? What do I have to do to change to make these APIs public? My documentation has to be incredible. It has to be quick to onboard. It has to be super easy for everyone to understand how to use. My security has got to be through the roof. Like, we've got these kind of things that you've got to mature, the maturity gates that you've got to jump through that happen.
And so that's kind of the product side. The next P, platform. Tell us a little bit about platform.
Yeah, platform is the most overused word, I think, in tech at the moment. I came in going to call this the three most through overused P's, but this platform, I was coming in doing a bit of research to do this, and I've actually got a little quote here from Marty Keegan. About platform, I think it sums it up kind of well. There are too many so-called platforms out there that are really just unfinished products. The team that didn't do the work required to provide a complete solution so they might market it as a platform and push the work off on the consumer or the developer to finish it. If you don't have multiple commercial software products as a service built upon a software, then you're not on a platform in the same sense that I'm describing. Right? Pretty good. You need multiple products. If I take it even back a step, if I was talking to a non-technical person, and I have to do this a lot, I think the platform, I really like to think of it as a way of connecting two things. And I think the train platform is really good in this analogy, because a train platform where you go and stand and wait connects the people riding the train with the train that comes in and out. And that train platform could just be a bare piece of concrete in the desert, or it gets upgraded with more capabilities like some shade, a vending machine, a toilet, a kiosk, information, security, some TV cameras, you upgrade it. Then you start thinking about who owns the platform. And it's generally the people who have the service, right, who are producing the service. So the train company, that they built the train, they beat the tracks. They go, how do we get the people on the train? Well, we need to build the platform. And then you get this two-sided marketplace of the train company and the people riding the train. And if you don't keep offering better and better features or capabilities or better usability, you're going to start losing those people riding the train. So, yeah.
It's not the first time I've heard the train analogy for API platforms. So it must be a thing.
Let's give it some tracks. Let's make it get.
The platform one's hard because you can hear, I hear businesses say we want to be a platform business. We're going to provide a platform to others.
So and then, used.
And then you hear others. Yeah, yeah. Like you can hear it at a business level that a business is a platform business. You can hear it at the product kind of level where software level, we built a platform for others to create on. And I definitely resonate with those comments, the quote you read out. And then look, also there's ones of like you go out and you might buy an API platform. You might buy a cloud platform. And these are all these ones start making it really confusing.
Definitely.
As to what's going on, and then yeah, so what's your view on platform? Like, when is there a budget? Do you budget for the platform itself? Like, in order to build out these processes, is there a team that you've got dedicated at REA to the platform component?
Yeah, it's something we're negotiating with at the moment. The team is very small. It was two of us. My partner, a colleague, has gone to another place in REA, got a promotion somewhere else. So I'm down to one at the moment, but it's something we're really discussing getting more funding in this and building out more of those features.
How do you provide more of the platform? Yeah,
exactly. So at the moment, the strategy is I've got a great vision of what we need to build. I've got, you know, mirror boards for days of how to migrate to the next technology, a full roadmap of what to do. But now to get that roadmap built, it's a lot of negotiating with the existing teams that say, oh, we're going to release a new API and we need a way to manage the permissions of that API.
Yep.
Well, okay, I've got you covered. Here's a month's worth of work and how to do it. Please be a good citizen and build this for the platform.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's about being that technical product manager role, right? Knowing what you need to support this. What are the maturity gates? What if we want to be able to get to the next step, this is a clear plan forward. Now we're funding this currently, you know, horse trading, but we're looking to get a full team to really ramp up this initiative.
Yep. Okay. And then the last P you mentioned was program. Talk to us a little bit about program.
Yeah, I think the program is the next evolution of you've got your platform, you've got this really sweet thing, but the API program is more about thinking about what the long-term life cycle and this evolution of your API gateways happening. We know we're evolving. We know it's going to get more and more users, a broader range of users, become more public. So the API program is about setting up these maturity gates and maturity models of what to go next. It also looks at things about life cycle. I don't think we talk about the life cycle of an API enough. We talk about design, development, testing, release, but no one ever talks about retirement. And we need to talk about retirement.
And also, you know, providing an API out there that's sending lots of data to lots of partners, it's not free. But yeah, it's a good point. Like there's a lot of focus on the build and release cycle.
Right. It's for some people, it's a three-month bank process of emails going back and forward and a bunch of fancy dinners to figure out if you're allowed onto our API. Another place, it might be an instant sign-up with an API key emailed to you within minutes. And really it's that organic growth of the business of where you got to. And going back to my maturity model point, those maturity models or understanding how your APIs will evolve from internal to partner to public, 95% of the time you'll do this over a 10-year period or something. Being ready for what the next phase gives you lets you build the right things into your platform early enough so you can support the next leap up and have the next level of complexities to support partner to public or something like that.
GDPR, upgrades. Like, it's not an easy...
Exactly. And if it's new, your development team can freak out a little bit and go, oh, I've got a short time frame. I don't really know what this is. You can lose motivation. You can throw the rhythm off of your whole team on a lot of these kind of things.
It's a really good point. Yeah, really addressing that part of the life cycle is something that a program needs to look at, and how you're going to deal with that.
And someone needs to sit over all of the APIs and say, what is the consistent message or products we're releasing over this? And how we, when we release a new version, what are we doing with the old versions? How are we going to retire one? How are we going to get people to migrate? What are we going to say? What's our pitch? What's our focus? Or where are we driving this data? So when we are in meetings with these partners or public APIs and go, oh, this is the APIs that are coming. This is what we're selling. We're really looking like a big professional organization.
And I think the bit of internal teams gets overlooked on the program side as well. It's actually even over, let's call it like 50 people. But if you're talking like some of the organizations that I work with, you're talking thousands of engineers. Mm-hmm. And to try and drive change across that, where you're getting people to go from this mindset of like, oh, well, you just kind of figure out who the right person to talk to is, and I just go and chat to them and they tell me how to integrate with their service, or I don't bother and I just build my own thing. Mm-hmm. To try and shift that mindset, it's not just at a developer level, it's also at a project and a program level where you've got to start influencing how budgets are done. You know, to your point of people contributing a bit to a new common flow, you know, getting a program to try and another program of work to try and allocate some of its funding to that. They're not really...
You've got to make people believers. You've got to make your internal team believer of what you're doing is the right thing. So they're willing to sacrifice their own roadmap by X amount of weeks to help you out and make it better for the future.
And put themselves on the line a bit, because it's then they've got to go and say, hey, you know, we've gone down this path. We're going to have to push out by a month on the release because we've got to do the right thing and do the API platform. Like, that's actually a big thing for people's careers.
And it really
to go
is.
And push back.
At ARIA, I think we do a really good job of internal branding, and a lot of organizations miss out on this. But when we create a team or create an initiative, there's our initiative name, there's swag, there's hoodies, t-shirts, stickers. We build out like these common platforms or core things. We put it under an internal brand and really give it like a go-to-market internally. So people are aware of this thing and really want to be involved and contribute to it. Because without getting the excitement internally, you're not going to get the adoption internally.
Yeah,
really going to take years and years to catch up to the outside world.
How do you think about training in the context of a program? Do you think it's the API platform teams? I'm probably misusing in the context that let's be nice to me today and go, oh, I've used the word correctly, but you know, in the context, is that the API program or platform's responsibility to train?
I think it starts off there because they're the people thinking about this, right? The teams building the APIs are really thinking about the other things about getting there out to market. They're worrying about
ship.
Like their product manager, their BA, someone's coming and go, put this data source in an API. Cool. And they kind of forget it about it then. It's an API team who's in the coalface talking to the outside world, trying to negotiate these interfaces, get these adoptions. They're the one thinking about this program. So I think this central team is the ones you want this information going through. So your feature teams can run fast and just build features, build APIs, build products, and let that platform team really handle the getting it out there and that side of it. And that comes with training. You have to.
So just wrapping that up a bit, the last thing you really were keen to chat about is GraphQL. And
yes.
So GraphQL... it's been fascinating to me to watch in that it gets adopted a lot on the web app side and developers love it, but then in API portals it hasn't really taken off. And this is what you and I were riffing on before. I'd love you to kind of share your two cents on GraphQL.
I think GraphQL is one of my favorite techs, and it was built for very specific purposes. And when I go around to conferences that are more web and app focused, everyone's talking about GraphQL, right? Because it's created by Facebook. It's solving that overfetching, underfetching problem. It's really UI focused friendly kind of development, and the back end can work with it just as easy. But when I go to API conferences, we're all talking to B2B kind of deliveries, people, they get an icky feeling in their mouth about GraphQL. They don't think it's the right technology. But really, it's just another transport layer. It's another interface mechanism that can be really beneficial because it solves overfetching and underfetching. It also solves versioning, which is some of our big problems when we get to lifecycle management of a program. I think there's a blog I really recommend everyone to read. I'm not sure if you've read it. It's by Oz Nova. It's called You Are Not Google. And the premise of the thing is we're not 99% of the people as developers do not work for Google, Facebook, Apple, like these big guys who have their own technological problems of, you know, we need a billion writes per minute or something like that. We don't have these problems, so we don't need to create these technologies to solve them. But we do anyway. We that's a cool thing, right? We go and build React because they're doing it. Cool, let's all jump on React. Hadoop, wow, amazing technology. Let's use it. We don't have the same problem, but this whole blog says read the white paper, understand why they built something before you decide to adopt it. Don't just adopt something because it's cool. So GraphQL is one of those things that it's built by Facebook. It's solving a lot of those overfetching, underfetching problems and versioning. Ergo, I think it works well in the API space.
Why do you think it hasn't been adopted as much as say, let's just call them RESTful as the gold standard or the current standard, whatever? Why do you think GraphQL is not out? Because GraphQL has been out there for a while now.
Yeah, really. 2014.
People have been using it in anger for a while now. It's not like it's a new thing that's kind of come about. You know, on the website, as you say, I've seen it used in anger for, well, I'm going back 4 or 5 years now. People, don't quote, if someone's like, oh, but hang on a sec. But, you know, a couple of years ago, yeah, I remember using it in anger in quite serious situations, but it just hasn't come about in API land. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the drive is from UI teams a lot of the time to use GraphQL because it makes their life easy. They're not overfetching the data. They can control what they want. They build one page and their product managers iterate on it, and they're given a new UI design that asks for a different field. It's easy for them to just replace the query and do it, or they can build multiple pages. With the APIs, it's a much slower process, right? We do all this back and forward schema design with our partners or our consumers of our APIs. And then we probably have 3-4 months before we release it. And when we release it, we have 6 months before it's adopted. We're a much slower glacial thing in the API. So the same benefits of GraphQL aren't seen or aren't pushed for by the consumer because we do this a lot of upfront planning a lot of the time.
And I think you got that cross organizational kind of contract coming into place where a bit more certainty is needed, and you know, some docs that are like, this is what you're going to get each time. This is exactly how it works. It's got that simpler aspect to it where you know what you're going to get each time you make a query in theory. So I think that's one of the big things that the RESTful approach has going for it. And even an XML, like RESTful XML, not just JSON. When I say REST, everyone goes to JSON, including myself, but like even XML has got that kind of, or SOAP, it's got that kind of like certainty of I know what I'm going to get back.
The big downsides, though, are that you lose a lot of visibility of how it's used. GraphQL is fantastic for field level visibility. You know what field is consumed and what's not. But if I build a big REST endpoint, you know, that's a whole bunch of reporting data, I have no idea which of those fields are used and which not. I can't really upgrade them. I can't modify them. I've got to create a new version to add a new data field. I don't have these problems with GraphQL. I can look at which part of the graph is being used, deprecate it, add new bits, update it. And it's just for the consumers. It's much easier for the API consumer to just go and add a new property on the existing query to get the new data fields. I think a company that does this really well is Seek. I've seen this from afar, but they made the switch from full REST API platform to being 100% GraphQL all in and migrating all of their partners to use the GraphQL. And now the benefits is their documentation is always up to date, live. They have live code examples of like their version of a CRM built off their own GraphQL systems. They have no problem get versioning. They get more adoption. They get more visibility of how their graphs are used.
Yeah, awesome.
It lets people experiment more, right? I can find data a lot easier in GraphQL than when I look at a REST API. And if I've got 100 endpoints in one Swagger doc, I get lost about what data points are in there and what's useful for my business. GraphQL makes it easier to explore and adopt.
Awesome. Look, Eric, thank you so much for coming on with us today. That it's been awesome having you. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and ideas with the audience. Really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I loved it.
Thanks for listening. I hope you gained some valuable insights from today's episode. To catch the next episode in the series, visit terem.tech/podcast. That's terem.tech/podcast.